congratulations, Dr. Rahman, on an excellent article for this
issue
of Neurosurgical Focus. It has a very broad range, and we very much appreciated your contributions and your co-authors' contributions to this issue.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It's really a wonderful collection of articles that we have, and I have to admit that it was a little bit difficult to choose sort of the best article that was present in this issue, but yours stood out in particular for its timeliness, given the fact that radiosurgery has really been, as I would say, the early poster child for minimally invasive procedures, and I congratulate you on that. Why don't we begin with sort of the simple stuff. What was the most interesting thing to you, being a young neurosurgical resident, looking at the historical past of neurosurgery? It is quite a pleasure to see young individuals with an avid interest in the history of neurosurgery. And so what was sort of your motivating focus on this?
Well, you know, I really wanted to learn more about linear accelerator radiosurgery, specifically because, you know, how to deliver radiosurgery in the past has been an issue of controversy. And now we've kind of reached an age where both gamma knife and linear accelerator are accepted modes of treatment for radiosurgery. And I really want to understand where this controversy came from and learn about more about linear accelerators and how they were initially thought to be modified for radiosurgery. And in investigating that, I actually came across a lot of interesting people. The pioneers in the fields of stereotaxis and radiosurgery were fascinating to me, and it was from my initial research into the history of linear accelerator radiosurgery where I actually then decided to, you know, we went ahead to decide to write another review paper about the early pioneers in stereotaxis, just because that in and of itself was so interesting. You know, the history of Horsley and Clark and how they were initially great colleagues and they came up with this, you know, first publication about the use of a stereotaxic frame in the journal Brain. However, subsequently had an argument and by some reports, each one of them took half of the frame and were unable to use it for further research because each of them had half of the frame. And so, you know, in learning about them and then all the events that took place to lead up to the, you know, discovery or, you know, the publication by Lars Leksell in 1951 of the gamma knife and its use in radiosurgery, for me it was very interesting and very worthwhile.
That's wonderful. If you can, as you mentioned, radiosurgery and stereotaxis go hand in hand, one not being able to come to its full extent or its fullest potential until the other really came into existence. What other major issues you feel were important in the development of stereotaxis? You briefly mentioned Horsley and Clark, but who else do you feel was instrumental in bringing the instruments ready for the radiosurgical explosion?
Right. So Horsley and Clark, you know, described this first stereotactic frame, but it was wrought with problems of accuracy because they did not have any, didn't have access to cranial imaging, and therefore were using external skull landmarks. However, this problem was the research focus of Spiegel and Weissis, who, you know, Spiegel came over from Europe in the, you know, during the Nazi era in, around World War II, and quickly found Weissis as his mentee, and eventually, you know, became great colleagues. And Weissis worked in Spiegel's lab as a medical student and as a neurosurgical resident, and actually funded his way through school by playing semi-professional baseball and poker. And, you know, I found that some of these stories of these people who have contributed greatly to neurosurgery, or even their private lives, were so interesting. And, you know, so I do feel that they ended up, you know, being able to use X-rays and ventriculograms as well as the calcified pineal gland on X-ray, were able to use intracranial landmarks to be able to improve accuracy of their stereotactic frame.
That's terrific, and that sort of leads us in to the present article that you present in this issue of Neurosurgical Focus. What was, do you believe, the most critical part in the birth of radiosurgery as we see it today?
I think the critical part was, you know, all this, all these researchers were really focused on stereotaxis and trying to focus into certain structures of the brain, and that is critical for radiosurgery. You know, the having a defined target is critical to be able to deliver a high dose of radiation to patients. If you don't have defined targeting, you can't increase the dose that you're giving because you'll start to involve structures. Normal structures of the brain. And so being able to put all this information together with a stereotactic frame and then create a source of, or be able to incorporate a source of radiation that could be modified to directly target a brain lesion was completed by, you know, Lars Lexell in 1951. And I think that was really, you know, a critical time for radiosurgery. He was the one who coined the term, and he, you know, really had foresight to think that, you know, he wanted to use some minimally invasive way to be able to target lesions in a very defined manner, and decided to use radiation as his, you know, therapeutic tool. And I think that his publication and discovery in 1951 was really critical for the history of radiosurgery.
Wonderful. Now, you mentioned Lars Lexell several times in the development and birth of radiosurgery,
mm-hmm.
In particular during his earlier years in World War II. This is, of
right.
course, a name that's well known to every neurosurgeon
right.
that's in practice. Perhaps you can discuss a little bit some of the individuals and factors that influenced Dr. Lexell in going the route of radiosurgery, and ultimately, as a sort of a sidebar, as a sequelae, the Gamma Knife in particular.
You know, so Lars Lexell had attended a meeting during World War II, a neurosurgical meeting in Oslo, and had actually met with a gentleman named Sir Hugh Cairns, and he actually discussed with him this idea that he was interested in using some narrow beam, and he was thinking at the time either X-ray or ultrasound, into the brain to ablate certain pathways, and he was specifically interested in pain alleviation. And Sir Cairns gave him really positive, feedback and was like, I think this is a great idea. And it was because of the positive feedback he got from his colleague at this meeting. It was actually the first Scandinavian neurosurgical meeting in Oslo, and he, after getting this feedback, decided to go back and work on this in this project at Uppsala. And however, he did tinker along with his colleague Larson with different potential sources for radiation when he decided that he was going to use radiation. And they even considered using a linear accelerator, but at the time the technology was not advanced enough to make it practical to use a linear accelerator to be able to deliver radiosurgery. And so ultimately he decided to create his own device that he named the Gamma Knife.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. It's funny that you mentioned this, but if we look back at history, my being very interested in the history of neurological surgery myself, it's very interesting that functional surgery is always a focal point in the birth of new technologies. The lobotomy, which has a very, very controversial history, is part of the functional aspects of neurosurgery, as well as what we were just discussing with radiosurgery. And now if we look at minimally invasive neurostimulation, it seems as though the idea of trying to alter function has been a very major focal point, yet something that constantly is just a little out of reach for us in every aspect. And hopefully we'll be able to catch up with it.
Yeah, hopefully.
What do you think, switching over now primarily to the LINAC movement, what do you think was the primary motivating force in developing the LINAC. We had evidence back in the 50s that Lars Laxell had brought about a new field in neurosurgery and was using cobalt source. What was it that really brought this tremendous push to develop LINAC?
Well, I think initially, so, you know, initially the Gamma Knife, he had to create the Gamma Knife because he couldn't use the tools that he had readily available for him that delivered radiation to be able to do what he wanted to do, and which was to deliver high-dose radiation to a very defined target. However, as linear accelerator technology advanced, especially through World War II, where it was really advanced for use of radar during the war, linear accelerators became widely used in medicine for delivery of conformal or radiation. And this widespread use of linear accelerators made them available at almost every institution. And so once radiosurgery was, you know, proven to be very beneficial and indispensable in the treatment of neurosurgical patients, being able to disseminate this technology widely and make it widely available to people, with limited cost, became a driving force. And at the time, because linear accelerators were everywhere, and modifying them for radiosurgery was a lot more cost effective or cost efficient compared to purchasing a brand new Gamma Knife that could be used only for stereotactic radiosurgery, really drove this research into trying to modify linear accelerators for radiosurgery. In addition to that, some of the early pioneers in modifying linear accelerators for radiosurgery, they were really interested in being able to apply this concept of stereotactic radiosurgery to places outside of the cranium. And being able to apply stereotactic radiosurgery to the spine or to extracranial sites would really involve a system that could be modified in a way that the Gamma Knife couldn't, since the system at that time was kind of like a helmet with these, you know, cobalt sources.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so it seems as though it was the need for a generalizable, more expansive approach that would make it more economic for hospitals that was one
Absolutely.
Of the driving forces, it seems.
Absolutely.
You mentioned some of the limitations. Any other limitations that existed in LINAC besides just the inability to get the technology up to speed, whereas cobalt source had already gotten there?
Right. So, in addition to the technology, was a problem with accuracy. So even once they were able to, in the early years, able to show that they could deliver stereotactic radiosurgery, their accuracy was not as good as the Gamma Knife. And it took, took several years and many modifications to be able to get that accuracy better. The reason for that difficulty with accuracy initially was that the linear accelerator technology, works by accelerating electrons, and then those electrons collide with a metal target, and most of the energy released from that energy transfer is by heat, but some of that is released in photons as the electrons, change direction. And in order to be able to do this and be able to deliver arcs of radiation to patients so that normal brain tissue gets a very small dose of radiation and the target gets a high dose, they had to have the patient on a moving couch as well as a gantry that would rotate around the patient to deliver those photons of radiation. And having two or multiple moving components made achieving accuracy in linear accelerator initially much more difficult than Gamma Knife, where a patient would kind of slide in with a fixed helmet and be able to get radiation that way.
Great. Well, Laxell was quoted as having said that the tools used by a surgeon must be adapted to the task, and where the human brain is concerned, no tool can really be too refined. I believe that might be why he turned to cobalt beam in the 40s and 50s, and you sort of very much intimated at that. What do you think he would believe or his issues would be if he was here today looking at the technology that we have? Do you think that he would have made the same choice?
For linear accelerator?
Versus his cobalt beam.
Right. You know, I do think that the people that make the big, you know, discoveries in neurosurgery are never satisfied with what we currently have. And I think that, you know, if Lars Lixell existed today, he would probably be looking for an option that doesn't even exist yet. And, you know, to be able to improve, you know, what we do right now is so much better than what we did 50 years ago, but, you know, we still have a long ways to go in being able to perfect this treatment for patients or being able to, you know, increase the indications for stereotactic radiosurgery. And I do think, though, that linear accelerator technology has come to the point that he would have the option, of choosing linear accelerator and would have, you know, I think equivalent results if he had chosen Gamma Knife. But I think I really truly believe, because of the type of person he was, that if he existed today, he'd be looking for something else altogether.
Wonderful. Well, unfortunately, that's all the time that we have. I thank you very much for your participation in this podcast. I believe that this truly sheds some additional light to the article that sort of fills in a lot of the information that you so eloquently provided with your co-authors with this article and the article that immediately precedes it in the issue. I think that this is very much a dovetail to the entire neurosurgical focus issue that looks at neurosurgical technology that spans from looking at art and the development of technology and imaging all the way through cervical disease and, of course, radiosurgery. I really appreciate the amount of work and input that you and your team have done to shed further light for our readership and our listeners on LINAC radiosurgery. Thank you again for your participation.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.